Welcome, everyone. This is Imagine All the People podcast, where we learn to appreciate our experiences and cherish the bond we have as human beings. I am your host, Daniel, and today I had the opportunity to talk to Marie, an incredible and resilient woman whose husband passed away a few years ago.
Yeah, I grew up in a family of five. I'm the youngest one of five children, and I was the fourth one to come into the family, the first one born into the family, which is always a bit confusing for people. In a nutshell, I grew up with four adopted siblings and my eldest brother came after me. So it's a bit of an unusual story how I was brought up. And it was quite an emotional roller coaster for me growing up with four adopted siblings. And there were a lot of life lessons that probably prepared me for life quite differently to most people. So I grew up in Austria. And that's where the accent comes from, in case people are wondering. And I moved to Australia in 2004. I spent 7 years traveling back and forth, and 2004 I finally moved here for good. And a year later, I met my husband. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's in a nutshell.
That's awesome. And now you talked about how you were brought up with four adopted siblings. That's really interesting. So can you tell me a little bit more about how do you think that experience shaped your outlook on life?
It gave me a whole lot of lessons about sticking up for yourself in terms of becoming your own authentic self without, you know, falling into the shape that other people have prepared for you. And that was a really, really big lesson for me because I often really stepped back and didn't allow myself to fully step up because I often got, oh, well, of course you are successful, or of course you're beautiful, or of course you're this or that, because you're the only one born into this family. So anything and everything that was somewhat related to success or to praise or something beautiful or positive was straight away put down as in, oh, it's because you're the only one born into the family. And that in itself is really not the privilege. It's just something that happened. It's not, it was not for me to decide. And, the lesson that I took away from that is to really connect to your authentic self and allow yourself to be who you're meant to be and to step up and shine like everybody's supposed to do in this world.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for your beautiful insight. Now that we're talking about childhood, can I ask you, what was your first experience with grief like and how did you cope with it?
My very first experience was probably not quite an intense one. It was my grandmother passing in our house when I was 12. But the first really intense experience I had was when my dad passed when I was 20 and he was only 46. So that was a really, really intense experience for me because I was very much a daddy's girl from the age of 12. And losing him that early was really rather unexpected. It was not as unexpected as with my husband because, you know, brain aneurysm is very sudden and very unexpected. My dad had cancer, and yet when the cancer came back the second time, it took him within a month. So there was not a lot of time to really prepare for that. And I believe you never really are prepared to lose someone, no matter how long ahead you know about it.
Definitely. And I think it's always going to be difficult no matter what. Now, how did you cope with losing your grandma and losing your father?
So with my grandmother, I think I was fairly young. I was 12, but thinking that now, it's actually quite hit me because my son, my older son, is 12 now, and my boys were only 10 and 8 when they lost their dad. So it's actually quite interesting when you see that from different perspectives, similar ages, what we have experienced. But with my dad in particular, because that was the one that hit me the hardest back then, I literally did not know how to cope. I had no coping mechanisms. I didn't have a background in coaching like I do now. I did not have any tools. I just know when my dad passed that most of my friends sort of stayed away more and more. And when I addressed that later, they said, well, we didn't know how to help you. So I'm like, well, it would have been amazing if you could have just been there, even if you don't know what to say. It often requires people to just be there and listen, and not, you don't have to say anything. That's where most people go wrong. They swamp you with advice. They think they have to say something really clever, or they think they have to make you feel better. They don't. What you need the most when you lose somebody is somebody to sit with you and just hold space for you, just be there with you. So I did not know how to cope. I walked around the whole year pretty aimless and working a lot because I fell through the cracks of the social network. There was no financial support and I had not finished my studies yet. I was right in the middle of my college degree and but I already had my own place and my parents were supporting me. So from one day to the next, I had to support myself with no job, nothing. So I literally started working while doing my college and trying to cope on an emotional basis, which did not go very well. So luckily I had some very, very close people, one in particular, I call her my soul sister in Austria, who just was there for me and stepped up and really held space for me and listened to me cry. And that's probably what I needed the most, somebody to just let me cry it out and be there and listen and not having to say anything.
Wow. That must have been really hard. I'm really sorry to hear that. Now, you were a student and all of a sudden you just lost your emotional support, your familial support, and to some extent your financial support. So can you tell me a little bit more about how you grew from that experience and what ultimately resulted from losing your father at that time?
So it literally, my father passed literally in that summer break that we had between the first and the second year of the advertising college I went to. And when I came back, I, you know, had the second year to run through, and I was quite lucky that the principal of the college actually created that support for me. So there was a PR agency in Austria that always decided they wanted to, that had always planned, I should say, not always decided, that always planned to support one student that needed a support from a financial perspective. And they said, we're just going to start this program a lot earlier than we had planned. And they literally supported me and paid for my student fees, which was absolutely amazing. I had huge support with all the teachers. Everybody really just pulled together and supported me from an emotional level as well, which was amazing because my final exams were just an absolute disaster for me. I remember that, like I could not focus on studying or anything, and they literally carried me through that, which was really beautiful. Like students, likewise, as teachers, were really, really there for me. They probably were a lot bigger support to me than my actual true close friends at that stage. Because they saw me on a daily basis, you know, they saw what I was going through, and there were a lot of tears and a lot of hiding away and just not coping well. And I didn't know what to do with that, because when it comes to relationship with my mom, with my siblings, I never had a really close relationship with my siblings, and they didn't really know how to cope either. They actually came to me for support, although I was the youngest one. And my mom basically did the same thing, you know, the mother-daughter relationship completely reversed. She called me for anything and everything she needed, you know, how do you cook that? What do I wear? How do I cope with this? And I think I know now that people have always said to me, Marie, you're a natural born leader. And I never knew what to do with that. I never knew how to take that because, you know, my subconscious was so trained on not accepting these things in that, you know, that from my upbringing. But people were always drawn to me. People always came to me for advice. People always put me into this leadership position without me actually taking it. And it just always, I always got that handed on a silver tray. So when my father passed, it was not the most comfortable thing to take over that position, but that's what people wanted me to do. And I tried to do that the best I could, but I was way overwhelmed with that position that I was put in.
And I mean, something that really stood out to me was you saying that the role between your mom and yourself really reversed. And it wasn't just a traditional mother supports daughter relationship. It was almost the other way around.
Yeah.
So just tell me more about that.
Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, for my mom, it was really the hardest, which I understand so much more now, because now I have lost my own husband, so I see it from a very different perspective all these years later. However, at that stage, you need to understand, my mom had just, you know, all of us siblings had only just moved out about 2 years prior because we had lived in a different part in Austria. And then we all moved to Vienna together into a larger house that had all these apartment units. So this is where all of us got our own apartment, which meant we all moved out at the same time. You know, my eldest brother had already moved out because, you know, he worked somewhere else. But 4 out of 5 siblings, we still lived at home at that stage. And then we all moved out at once when we moved to Vienna. And 2 years later, my dad passed. So my mom went from running a household with, you know, her husband and 4 or 5 kids being at home and cooking for all of us and caring for all of us and doing all the washing, to moving to Vienna, everybody moving out, just getting used to this, just the two of them sort of scenario, you know, something that you probably look forward to when you run a household with 5 children, that you finally get time to spend with your husband and just the two of them, and then he passes. So it was really quite intense for her to go through this journey of losing so much at once, and it reverted into, I don't know what to do with this, and I know that you're really strong, so can you please help me, sort of behavior. I don't think she was aware of it at all, what was going on. But looking back at it now, and from the perspective that I have now as a daughter, as a widow, as a coach, like all of that gives me very, very clear insight of what she must have been going through back then, that back then I could not see. Back then, I just experienced it as quite overwhelming and way too much responsibility for my age.
Mm-hmm. And how did you meet Rob in the first place?
Yeah, so the way we met in the first place was actually through his younger brother. I met his fiance at the time first in a karaoke club that I used to go to with a friend of mine. And we got on really well. And, you know, as women do, we chit-chatted about men. And I said, oh, it would be nice to meet a nice man for a change because, you know, that's such a funny, I don't even know why I'm telling you this story now, but I guess you asked. So, yeah, I look relatively young for my age. So I always had guys come up to me that were a lot younger. And I was like, oh my God, just get serious. You know, like I don't want to be in a relationship with guys that much younger than me. And that's why I said that to her, that comment, you know, it would be nice to meet a nice man for a change and not these young guys. And her reaction was like, oh, I know a nice man. I'm like, yeah, that's what they all say. She's like, no, seriously, I know a really nice guy. And she started telling me about Rob. And she's like, oh, he's actually my fiance's brother. And I said to her, so where's the catch? Everything you're telling me is way too good to be true. It's like, no, there is no catch. And I was like, all right, there's something, that there must be something off because, you know, he sounds way too perfect. And to cut a very long story short, she actually arranged a double date without telling me. And she's like, oh, a couple of us are going to play putt-putt, you know, mini golf. Why don't you just come along and you can meet him? And the couple of us was her fiance, Rob, and I. So it was a full-on set-up double date. But, yeah, we met, we connected on a really, really beautiful level. And it was not fireworks straight away, but it was a little flame that had started burning lighter and brighter by the day. And it never stopped. I really kept falling in love with Rob more and more by the day, all through the years, even when we were married. It just kept growing. And there was a lot of love there. It was a very, very special relationship to me.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And I can hear the passion in your voice. And now, how did you guys make the vow and become husband and wife?
Rob, actually, so we met in May. He moved in August. He proposed in October and we got married in March. So it all happened really, really fast. And if anyone would have told me, you know, oh, you're moving to Australia and 10 months later you meet your husband and 10 months later you're married, I would have gone like, are you nuts? No way. It's like, mm-hmm. If he's really Mr. Right, he'll still be Mr. Right in 3 to 5 years. There's no need to rush. But when Rob proposed, there was just no doubt at all. I just knew he was the one and it was perfect. And I thought, yeah, I didn't even think like, why wait? I just said, of course. With no question in my mind, he proposed to me under the stars on a Horsebury River on a houseboat on a long weekend, October long weekend. And I said, of course, straight away. And we got married 5 months later.
Mm-hmm. And he was obviously a very special person. So tell me a little bit more about your experiences as a newlywed.
Yeah. Being with Rob felt like a constant being in a pink bubble. Everything was just I felt so connected. I felt so loved and adored and nurtured and taken care of. I felt so safe around him. I felt literally, I don't know, he was my knight in shining armor. Do you know what I mean? I just really felt that was such a Prince Charming story. And everybody said that. And it just never changed. It was like that from day dot. And it was like that still when Rob passed. We were always known as that couple. You know, we ran around like completely, oh my God, we have found each other. This is just so beautiful to feel like that. I have been in a few different relationships before Rob, and they were all like a lot of fireworks and a lot of ashes thereafter, if that makes sense. And with Rob, it started completely differently. As I said, you know, there weren't these fireworks at first. The strongest feeling I had when I first met him was that I felt really comfortable around him. I felt I could so be myself, and he made me laugh. And that's when things were just growing and growing. And it was just from one, you know, catch up to the next, I was really looking forward to seeing him and to connecting with him and to hearing more about him. And I could just spend hours and hours talking with him. And I feel that is the one thing that is the most important thing in any relationship, that you actually love spending time with your partner and love talking to him. And that's what keeps a relationship alive, talking, communication. And we had a lot of that.
Mm-hmm. And now looking back on your childhood, where you grew up with four adopted siblings, how did that experience influence how you decide to teach your kids and how you decided to nurture them?
Yeah. So, Flynn, our first son, was born about 2 years or just under 2 years after we got married. And it's probably also due to the fact Rob and I always said we would have loved to have a little bit more time, just the two of us. Yet we met later in life. So we were both 33 when we got married, and we both knew that we wanted to have a family. So we got to the stage where we're like, you know, we shouldn't wait too long, because we don't want to be parents like in our 40s or anything. You know, we'd really like to have kids before 40. So we decided at one stage, you know, whenever it happens from now on, it's fine, we are ready. And it literally happened a month after I got pregnant, and I was like, oh my God, like, you know, so many friends of ours said, oh, if you want to have kids, you need to start trying. What a weird word to use. It's like the try to have children. It's such an awkward call to action, I should say, from friends, where it just took a lot longer to fall pregnant. And I always had this belief, and I shared that with Rob as well, that I said, when it's meant to be, we'll have children. You know, there is no rush, there's no stress about that for me. If it's meant to be, it's meant to be. And I always had this biggest belief, if it's meant to be, we'll have kids, and if we don't, we don't. I mean, we both really wanted to have kids, but I did not want to fall into this category of falling pregnant becoming a huge stress factor in our lives. I did not want to allow that. So yeah, we just let it all happen, and I fell pregnant a month after, which was amazing. Mm-hmm. So that was the first one, Flynn, and then Jed was born exactly 2 years after that. So both our boys were born in January, and the same thing happened. We were like, okay, we're ready for a second child, and I literally fell pregnant the same month, which is maybe a bit too much information for your podcast, since you asked. It was really just meant to be. Everything in our life just happened easily and naturally. There was no pushing, no pressure, no nothing. There was just when things are meant to be, they just happen naturally. And we both had that belief. And so, yeah, both our boys were born in a really happy place and in a really beautiful way. So both my birth stories are very positive and very beautiful memory for both of us.
Yeah, and that's incredible. Now, let's talk a bit more about Rob. If you're comfortable, of course, can you share a little bit more about your memories of how Rob passed, and can you walk me through that
day? Absolutely. The event was, Rob was on a business trip 5 hours flight away from us, and I talked to him the night before, and we had this really, really beautiful conversation, because we talked every day when he was on a business trip. He traveled quite a bit for work, and I remember we had this conversation. He was really tired because he had just flown over there the day before, and he was working the whole day, like, you know, getting up early, 5 hours flight, working the whole day, going to bed. And he said he went to this restaurant, and he was in the queue waiting to be seated, and this young couple started chatting to him and they had this beautiful conversation. And then they said to him, look, we see that you're here alone. Don't you want to come and join us? And he said, I was really tired, but they were so persistent and they really wanted me to sit. So I sat down with them and we started chatting. And he said, I actually talked to them about love and connection and about our relationship. And we always had this thing, and Rob loved sharing it, to talk to people about the Fast Love Language, which is by Dr. Gary Chapman. And he shared that with them. I don't know, are you familiar with the Five Love Languages, Daniel?
No, I'm not, unfortunately.
Okay, anyway, you do need to check it out now. But anyway, there, you know, five different ways how people feel love, experience love, show love. And he shared that with this couple because it really makes a huge difference for relationships when you do understand each other's love language and how people experience and understand love in a very different way. And it can really eliminate a lot of conflict when you do understand that and are aware of that. And we have used it in our relationship. We have used it in a relationship with our children. There's actually a test that you can do online on that website as well. I'm advertising here for Dr. Gary Chapman, but really it is so important. So he shared with me that he had this beautiful conversation with this young couple. And one of them was locally from Perth, where he was on a business trip in Australia. And the other one was actually from his dad's hometown in Treviso in Italy. And it was such a beautiful connection they made. And that was the last conversation he had with somebody other than me. And when he told me about this, I was really touched. And he said, look, I'm really, really tired. Let's talk in the morning. And my mobile phone had a technical issue with an update and I could not update it. So Rob said, oh, I'll wake you tomorrow, because I always use my phone as an alarm in the morning. And I said, but that would be 5 a.m. for you due to the time difference. He said, don't worry, because I have to be up at that time because I get picked up really early tomorrow. And I'm like, okay, no, that would be fantastic. So it was 5:30 for him and 7:30 for me. And I remember waking up in the morning and I looked at the alarm clock and it was 7:31. And I had this niggling feeling in my heart that I decided to ignore at that stage, because Rob was never late. Rob was always on time. He was the most reliable person I ever had. If he said I would wake you at 7:30, he would wake me at 7:30 on the dot. And my niggling feeling and my really weird sense that I had that something happened got stronger and stronger during the course of the morning, as you can imagine, because I still hadn't heard from him. And I got the kids ready for school and my little one wasn't feeling well. He wanted to stay home. So I said, okay, you just stay home, which I regretted later on, because there was no way I could have sent him to school. He had a really hacking cough, but I just really felt I needed to be by myself to make all these phone calls. I started to feel more and more uncomfortable and anxious about what had happened, that I'm usually not a very anxious person, but my gut feeling was telling me something happened. And then I know this sounds very bizarre, but I had this very bizarre vision of him collapsing in the shower. And I was like, well, I hate this picture in my mind. I don't want to believe this, you know, but I did call the hotel room where he was staying, because Rob left that in my phone. He always did that when he traveled somewhere. He gave me the itinerary so I would know where he is. Mm-hmm. And I called the hotel room and I said, look, my name's Maria Lessie. I believe my husband is staying with you. And please don't think I'm one of those freaked out wives. That's exactly what I said to them, who's stalking her husband. But I have this really bizarre feeling that something happened to my husband and I have not heard from him. He was supposed to call me at 7:30. Can you please send somebody up to his room and check? And I even added, I said, can you please check in the shower? I didn't tell them why, because I thought they must think I'm losing my marbles if I say things like that, you know. But that's exactly where they found him. My husband had collapsed in the shower and had a brain aneurysm and he died on the spot. So hours and hours later of me trying to call the hotel because they didn't call me back. And it was because of police procedures that they were not allowed to tell me over the phone. And they were trying frantically to find somebody, police, to come to our house in a little town where I live, south of Sydney. And we don't have a manned police station here in our town. So it took them forever and they couldn't find anyone. Meanwhile, I kept calling. I kept calling my husband's mobile. I kept calling the hotel. I then called my husband's boss and I said, James, I have not heard from Rob the whole day. It's so unlike him. Can you somehow check where he is supposed to be or what's going on? He said, leave it with me. And he called me back 5 minutes later and he said, I'm really sorry to tell you this, Marie, but he has not showed up for his first meeting. And that is when I knew something happened, because it's not like Rob. He would never not show up for a meeting without any apologies or any excuses. To this stage, I was still thinking in my mind he must have had an accident or something like that. So I called my best friend. She came over, and just when she started, she's like, we'll call all the hospitals in Perth. We just work our way down the list and we just call all of them and see if somebody has been admitted and submitted is the right word. Sorry, my bilingual brain. But anyway, just when she was at the first hospital, and I still remember how she was spelling the surname as my phone rang. And my phone rang and I picked it up and I saw the number was from Perth. So my heart sunk. And the guy on the other phone was a constable. I'm not going to mention his name now for obvious reasons, but he mentioned his name and he said, I'm Constable such and such from the coroner's office in Perth. And the weirdest part about this moment was, being bilingual, I had never heard the word coroner's office before. I didn't know what that meant. So I was still completely left in the dark at that stage. And he said, have you got somebody with you at the moment? I said, yes. And I signaled to my friend to hang up the phone. And he said, I'm really sorry to inform you, but your husband passed in a hotel room in Perth this morning. And that's when my whole world just collapsed. It was like somebody had pushed a massive pause button. You know, it was really, some part of me already knew, but then hearing it was so final, and it literally just put everything on hold for me.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And with your depiction of a grief, I just find it so poignant. I'm reminded of Joan Didion's novel, The Year of Magical Thinking, where she just talks about grief almost as if this imaginary force where it seems like the world around you stops, but life keeps going. It sort of dwarfs your vision of yourself as almost irrelevant and so minuscule to this world that the world doesn't care about you. And it's a scary thought. So when you heard about Rob passing at that exact moment, was this the feeling that you experienced?
Yeah, I have actually often described that very moment, you know, when you had like the old record players, like I'm showing my age here, but those of you who are in that age category would understand that. To me, it was like it was playing my absolute favorite song and then somebody took the needle and scratched it over the record and it stopped. That's what it felt like to me, that moment. And I remember I'm actually sitting here in my bedroom at the moment and it's literally 1 meter from me here where I just sank to the floor when I received that phone call, and I just sat there in absolute disbelief and my mind just started spinning like crazy because the boys were downstairs in the living room and we've got a split level open plan. They, you know, could have heard everything if they wanted to, and I just knew, I was like, oh my God, how am I going to tell that to the boys? How am I going to say that your father has just passed? I just, like, that's all that was going through my mind at that stage. It was like, first, full on disbelief. And then I'm like, how am I going to tell the boys? How am I going to tell them? You know, they were only 10 and 8 at the time. And I just sat there for a few moments, just really gathering my thoughts. And then I'm like, there is no sugarcoating. You need to go and tell them. They need to be the first ones to hear that. I did not want to make any phone calls. And, you know, like, I really needed a few moments to gather my thoughts anyway. But I knew that they had to be the first ones to hear. So I asked my friend to just stay up here and I walked downstairs, and they were sitting on the couch and they were both playing their iPads because they were ready to go to Hapkido. They did martial arts at the time and they were in their uniforms, you know, and ready to go. They were just waiting for me to make this last phone call, how I called it. And I sat down with them and I just asked them to put their iPads down, which they did straight away, which is quite unusual for kids that age, but they just felt that there was something really deeply, intensely happening. And I looked at them and I held both their hands and I said to them, I have no idea how to say this to you. This is probably the hardest thing I ever have to share with you. But your dad just passed away. And I said it straight out, and I'm getting quite emotional just thinking about that now. But it's just really, it was, I thought the only way I can say it is straight out. There is no sugarcoating a message like that. And I kind of expected that there would be tears and falling apart, but what I didn't expect was the screaming, and that really, really shook me to the core, because all they were doing was screaming, no, 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 and they hyped each other up when they did that, and it was so heartbreaking to hear that from them, and they were both crying, and I was holding them, and it was just a very intense moment of connection and holding space for them from day dot.
Mm-hmm. And now talk to me a little bit more about, not right after the incident, but days after the incident, or even weeks after the incident. Did life sort of resume normally, or was this always on the forefront of your
mind? No, not at
mind?
All. So I describe it as my brain went into functioning mode straight away. I just went, like, okay, what needs to be done? Next step, next step, next step. There was not a huge thinking ahead. There was just, what's the next step? And I knew the next step would be, I have to go and see his parents. I have to tell them in person. There's no way I could tell them that over the phone. And they live about 40 minutes drive away from us. And I said to the boys, pack your stuff. We're going to see Nana and Nono. And I asked my friend to just look after my animals. Like, oh, my animals, I only had a cat back then. We have a cat and a dog now. But I was like, can you just feed my cat? And here's my key, and I need to go. And she's like, yep, just go. Just let me know if there's anything I can do. She wanted to drive me. I said, no, there's no way. I need to do this by myself now. I just knew I could not have anybody with us. I needed to be there for them, and I did not want anybody else to be in that space. It was more like a protection for them as well. And I also knew that I was looked after. I said to her, like, nothing will happen to me right now. I know that. I'm so looked after right now. I knew I was so protected from a spiritual level that I would drive there and I would be fine. I knew that. There was such a huge trust in my heart that I will be fine driving. So I packed my kids in the car, and I, as much as I could, I just stretched back my arm and I tried to hold their hand while I was driving. And on my drive to Rob's mum and dad, I called his eldest brother first. I did tell him over the phone, and I said, I'm on my way to mum and dad, please don't call them, I'll tell them in person. Then I called my mom, because my mom was due to fly out and see us, like, literally 1.5 weeks later for my little one's first Holy Communion. So her flight was already booked. She said straight away she would change her flight and come early. And I said, please don't, because I have no idea what's going to happen in the next couple of days. Just leave it as is and wait till I reconnect with you. I just can't talk any further right now. I just needed you to know. I literally went into functioning mode. And then the last person out of the three phone calls I made on the way was Rob's sister. And because I know she's really, really close to the parents. And I said, Jane, please don't share that with your parents over the phone. They need to hear that in person. And she's like, no, absolutely, that's fine. What I didn't realize, of course, that with these phone calls, I had alerted pretty much the whole family, and it went around like wildfire. And half an hour after I got there, everybody came. Everybody just came to pay their condolences, to sit together. Like, you know, Rob's background is half Italian, half Mauritian, so there's a lot of family tradition there, and family is always together, and they've got huge families. But the moment I got there, it would have probably been about 6:30 at night at that time, and being a school night and with no phone call ahead, when I knocked on the door, they instantly knew that something had happened, because I would never show up unannounced just by myself with the boys, and they could probably feel instantly that something big has happened. And I didn't call Rob's other brother, because he still lived with his parents at the time. So when he opened the door, he just looked at me and said, Marie, what happened? And I said, my mum and dad here. I just need to talk to them. I just, you know, I don't want to say that twice. And mom came out of the bedroom, and dad, she's like, dad's in the shower. And I said, I really need him to be here. I need him to hear this. And she's like, Marie, what happened? And I just couldn't hold it back any longer, because, you know, the boys were standing there with me. And I said, Rob just passed. And she's like, what? No. And I said, yes, he did. I just received the phone call. And I told her, and she went into the bathroom where Rob's dad just had a shower. And I could hear the same thing happen, like that happened with the boys, the screaming, the falling apart, the screaming, no, no, no. It was just really, really heartbreaking. It was, they had just no words to describe that. It was such an intense moment, and the whole night was just the coming and going of family. I felt so isolated because I felt I had no capacity to connect to anyone. I just needed to sit and process. I just sat under the air conditioner. I was freezing so much, and I was sitting under this air conditioner where it was blazing warm air, and I had four layers on, and I was still freezing, which was most likely the shock. And I was just staring at my kids, and they drifted in and out of reality world and playing iPad because that was the only thing they could do to escape that reality, you know. So we spent that night at mum and dad's, and I was holding both my boys in my arms as I was trying to sleep. I hardly got any sleep that night, and I literally had this physical pain in my stomach as if somebody had emptied a bucket of acid in my stomach. That's how it felt physically. That was the intense pain of the loss. And the next morning, I had a conversation with that sergeant that had shared the news with me about Rob's passing. And he said to me that somebody has to come and identify his body, but it doesn't have to be me. And I called him the next day and I said, it has to be me. I cannot ask somebody else to do that. I need to see him. And I know that the boys probably want that too. So I packed up the boys and flew 5 hours across the country. And because of the time difference, we got there too late. We had to wait till the next day and went to the mortuary together. And I prepared them for everything that will happen. I prepared them that when they see Daddy, that he will look very peaceful, but his body will be very cold. I had to prepare them for all of that. I don't even know how I came up with all of that the night before, but I felt so guided. I felt so guided with everything that I had to say, that I had to do. And, yeah, we stood in that mortuary together, and it was a very, very intense moment. I could feel my husband around so massively, and it was not because his body was laying there. I really felt he was there with us. So the next few days were just, we were lucky that we had a family that used to be our neighbours that lived in Perth. They do live there now, and they took us in straight away. Because the last thing I wanted to do was to stay in a hotel room in Perth with the boys. And they took us in. They drove us to the mortuary. They fed us. They looked after my kids while I was doing 100 phone calls. I don't even know. It was just all organising and arranging things. And I spent about 3 days there before I flew back and met with Rob's family to talk about funeral arrangements. So that happened within the first 4 or 5 days after his passing.
And what you brought up before was this functional mindset, where it was just task after task after getting things done. Now, how long did it take you to revert back to your normal mindset?
So the transitioning back to that did probably not happen for another 9 months after Rob's passing, but what happened from going from functioning mode, I went into creation mode, actually. So that's how I describe it. That's just my very personal story. I went from functioning mode and working through tick lists and arranging the funeral and the wake and everything and preparing the eulogy and going through all of that. And then 4 days after that, we had my son's first Holy Communion. That was to be arranged as well, you know. I went into creation mode. I went into, okay, Rob and I had quite a few talks about what if something was to happen to either of us. And we always said, I'd love for you to create a life as happy as possible for our boys. I would want you to find love again. I would want you to have a happy life and just focus on that. Focus on love and connection and joy and happiness and laughter. And that was always theory. When it then happens, you know, it's a very, very different story. But I knew instantly when all these, you know, checklist moments were over of the first couple of weeks of arranging everything, I knew this was my next step on my checklist, create a happy life. It sounds really funny when you say it that way, but this is where I knew, and now I have to go into creation mode. And the way I coped with my grief and the way I coped with my life and knowing that I have to go into creation and I want to create a happy life for the boys, for me, and also to honour the love and connection that Rob and I had and created all our lives, I knew that that's what I had to continue. That's what I had to multiply. That's what I have to up my game, because now it's just me and I want to create a happy life for the boys. So by the reactions of people, I realized that I was coping with things very, very differently to most. Because when I looked at the advice that I got swamped with, everything was just around, well, people basically expected me to fall apart. And that was not my plan. My plan was to go into creation and to create a happy life. So people were always quite confronted by that, as in, wow, how can she be so positive? How can she be so happy? How can she do this or that? And I realized that through coping with it so differently, I wanted to write a book about that. So I did. In a matter of 4 weeks, I wrote and edited a book and came up with a cover. And that book was called Loving Life After Loss. So that's where I shared how I met Rob, how I fell in love with him, how we started our family, how I lost him and how I coped with it. And that book hit the top 100 list of Australia on the day of publishing. So I knew, oh my God, you know, I've got something that people need quite urgently. People need hope. They want to be happy. They need love and connection in their life. And what society offers as coping mechanisms, under quotation marks, is the complete opposite. It's usually keeping people stuck in the pain and the suffering. When you look into grief support groups, I don't see a lot of support. There's usually, it'll always be like that. It will never get better. There's always a hole in your heart. You know, life will never be the same. But who says that life will never be the same has to be negative? Of course, life will never be the same. You know, I lost my husband. How would it be the same without him? It can't. But it doesn't mean that it has to be negative, because that's what he taught me. You've got two choices in life, you know, every single day. And that's what I lived by. That's what I shared at the eulogy. That's what I made my whole life about. I probably didn't choose to lose my husband, but I can choose how I respond to it and what I do with my life. And I can choose that every single day. So that's what I did. And when the book came out and was really, you know, what a beautiful way to see what an impact that book made, you know, to land on the top 100 list of Australia. I then took the boys and traveled around the world for 2 months because I just wanted to get them away from all these first milestones without their dad, you know, the Christmas, the New Year's, both their birthdays in January. And while I was in Vienna, which is my town of origin, this is where I was born, this is where I, well, later lived, and then this is where I lived before I moved to Australia, I had this strong calling that I need to do more with that than just write a book. I just realized I have to start a movement to teach people what I'm doing, to share hope and love and laughter and support and hold space for people and teach them what it's like to allow happiness, joy and laughter back into your life when you have lost someone. And I thought, what more suitable title could I choose than the same title that I had for the book? Because it's so much more than just a title. It's a selector, it's a pre-selector for people who come into the movement. It's a call to action and it's a way of living, that loving life after loss. That's exactly what my whole life became about. And I started that movement about 9 months after Rob passed. And this is when I basically went back into a sort of new normal for me, into my old, you know, habits of positive mindset, positive thinking, let's do this, let's share it with others and go back into not just creation mode, but sharing that and teaching that, because that was my normal before Rob passed, being in sharing and teaching mode, because that's what I did for a living. I am a coach and now I use it to help others cope with loss in a very positive way.
Mm-hmm. And now that you're on the other side, coaching others through grief, and you're able to look back to how you yourself handled the grief back when you lost your grandma, you lost your father, and then now when you lost Rob, how do you think your perspectives has changed? And if you could go back in time, what would you tell yourself? And are there any actions that you would have changed?
I don't have a lot of regrets. I don't feel there are mistakes. The one thing that I wish that I would have learned a bit earlier is to stand up to people people that stopped me on the street or in a supermarket and bombarded me with advice and bombarded me with their stories about grief, as if that would help me in any way. You know, if they tell me, oh yeah, my sister lost her husband too, I'm like, so? And why are you telling me that? Because I haven't got enough to deal with my own loss right now. Mm-hmm. So you're dumping your loss story on top of mine. You know, I understand that most people do that in an attempt to make me feel that they understand what I'm going through, yet they don't. A, they don't because they haven't been through it. B, they don't because their story is most likely very, very different to mine, because no loss is the same. Every story of grief and loss is just as unique as the person experiencing it. So just by sharing your story, and everybody listening to this, if you ever meet someone who's sharing their loss with you, please don't add your story of loss, because it just adds to the heaviness and to the pile that they already have in front of them and don't know how to cope with. So it's not helping. I can tell you that. I promise you, it is not helping if you share your grief story with me when I have just lost someone. The only thing that helps is when you sit and listen and hold space, or hold that person, even better, you know, if you can hold them in your arms. Not everybody wants it, but a lot of people would really, really appreciate just to be held at that time. And if you're unsure, just ask. Is it okay to give you a hug? You know, it's just absolutely fine. Give people simple choices, you know, the whole, is it okay if I hold you or not? Would you like me to cook chicken dinner for you tonight, or do you prefer spaghetti? Like, give them two simple options to choose from. Don't go like, oh, let me know if you need help with anything, because I can promise you they won't. You do not reach out. When you're going through loss, when you're going through grief, you are literally completely out of empowerment in that situation, and you will certainly not reach out. I know that from my own experience, and I know that from working with literally thousands of people around the world now, that you do not reach out when you have experienced loss, because you just feel incapable of doing so. So yeah, that's pretty much my only regret, to not learn earlier, not know earlier how to tell people to just please not say these things to me, or to be able to just say, you know what, I cannot cope with this right now, and walk away. They will forgive you for that. They will forgive you. You get away with a lot when you have just lost your husband, I can tell you that. Do tell people when you're not coping with what they say to you. You don't have to take this advice. You know, you can just say, look, I'm not coping with this right now. I'm sorry, I have to go. And that's okay. It is okay. That is the one thing I wish I would have learned a little bit earlier.
Mm-hmm. And now, before we close, are there any last lessons or thoughts that you'd like to leave the listeners with?
Yeah. I really want to share with you that you are allowed to be happy. You are allowed to create your life the way you want it. You know, often I totally understand that you are in a situation right now where you feel like, but I haven't chosen this, Marie. I did not choose to lose my husband, my child, whoever it is that you have lost. No, you didn't choose that probably, but you can choose how you respond to it. It is like life handing you a completely blank canvas, and I'm handing you all the colors that you need and that you want to paint that canvas in a way you want it to be.
Wow, that's beautiful, Marie. And I just want to thank you for being so open with sharing your experiences and how you grew from it. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Daniel. I really appreciate your direct questions. I really loved it. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to the Imagine All the People podcast. This was Marie, and we hope that you will join us for the next episode.